Incorrect. Correct. This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on TNT Radio.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. I'm Richard Carson. I'm without my co-host, Mike Tennessee, who's gone for yet another walkabout, but we won't hold him up against the firing wall for that. I'm joined today by quite a regular guest and a font of knowledge in Professor Ted Steele. And we're going to range over a couple of topics today, but there's one that is vexing us to some degree, and probably an awful lot of people are troubled by the beehive mite strike. And I've got Professor Steele here to sort of wander us through what he knows about it, what we might be able to do about it, and what we shouldn't do about it, with the, I suppose, knee-jerk reactions we tend to get from our political leaders. So, Professor Steele, welcome to the Politically Incorrect Hour this afternoon, and you might like to just bring us up to date with what's A, happened, and B, your thoughts on the whole Varroa destructor, I should call it, that tended to turn up in volume around June 2022. Can I bring you on board and let's hear what you've got to say?
Richard, thank you very much for having me on again. This is a very interesting topic, a little bit outside my normal area that I would work, but as a biologist, I was fascinated by this story. So I understand it at the level of biology in a general way. I'm not a bee expert or a mite expert in any way, but I understand the biological story in a way that I can communicate, and I think it's fascinating. Last weekend, Greg Beerup, in the colour magazine of the Weekend Australian, published an extraordinary article describing this bee mite strike in the central coast of New South Wales in June and the hinterland regions. And it was quite an important article, one of the few articles in The Australian now, and I buy The Australian for the weekend to read articles like this that was really informative and helped us out immensely to understand what's going on, and also educated a lot of us to how important the beehive industry is for Australia's agriculture industry, particularly crop pollination and targeted pollination, you know, with the beekeepers putting hives into certain orchards and crop areas at certain times of the year to coincide with pollination waves so that you maximise pollination. So, and not just leave it up to the wind. And I'll come back to the wind shortly, because wind has traditionally been one big way of cross-pollination, but certainly amongst plants, the vectors like the bees are important cross-pollinators. Let's just put this in perspective of what the biology is here. The Varroa destructor, it's difficult to pronounce, Varroa destructor.
A bit of a mouthful.
It's a very small insect animal, about a millimetre, right, in length, and you can just see it by eye. It's about a hundredth the size of a honeybee, if you want to put it in perspective. This Varroa destructor has infested beehive colonies all over the world now, except countries like Australia. This is extraordinary. And, of course, this is familiar to Australia as an island nation. We seem to be the last to get these things. But nevertheless, it started to emerge as the beehive industry started to take off at the beginning of the last century, and then through the middle of the 20th century, when a beehive and agriculture became big deal, it got bigger and bigger. And then these mite infestations became a severe problem throughout the United States, particularly in the recent years in the United States, particularly Southeast Asia. It's been a problem for many years there. Europe, Africa, it's a major problem all over the world. Now, clearly, this is a relationship between a mite. It's like a little tick. It feeds off the body fat of a bee, right? It's like a little mite, doesn't have any eyes, just crawls along, gets on, but it can obviously pick up through its sensory feeders what it's getting onto and what its main targets are. Its main targets for me, from my reading in the literature, are bees and pollen. It likes getting associated with both of them. Anyway,
just if I can interrupt, does it kill the bee, or is it just live with the bee?
It debilitates the bee.
Right.
really debilitates the bee, slows them down, and it's the extent of the infestation in a beehive, right? Man-made beehive, that's the problem. If it gets to tipping point, it can take over and literally destroy the hive. So it is a serious problem. In the wild, I'm going to try and give you the biology of it. In the wild, the bees themselves, for example, in natural hives on the sides of trees or in cavities within trees, the bees have ways of dealing with them because they've had to deal with them for millions of years. It's clear that it's a deep evolutionary history of a host-parasite relationship between the mite, which is like a tick, and the bee. And what struck me as I was starting to read the literature a little bit and on key points, key targeted questions in the age of Google, you can get clear answers to these. What struck me is the hygienic behaviour of bees in general, and particularly honeybees. If they, for example, see a mite, a honeybee will catch it and kill it immediately, because very, that's what they do, right?
Very sensible thing to do.
Very sensible thing to do. They, but in their honeycomb hives, those little cells, which is part of the honeycomb, they're the nursing grounds for each, fertilised bee pupa or larvae that's growing there. And these mites lay their eggs or drop their eggs into these little cavities. Okay, and that's what happens. So in a way, because you don't know. The mite, I suppose, doesn't know which cavity it will hop into. It means that not all cavities, not all nursery grounds for these growing pupae, these larvae, are going to get infected, but some do, and they treat the growing larva of the bee in a similar way to the adult. They break open the skin as it's trying to grow, and they suck the fatty deposits out and feed off the fat of the larva, and these. And they can overwhelm the larva, but what's interesting about the bee, as well as killing a mite if it sees it, the worker bees go along to these cavities and uncap them because after they've deposited, the pupa, after they've got the fertilized egg, growing in those cavities. The worker bees actually inspect them. They go back to them, open them up, and if they find one that's been taken over by
contaminated.
Somehow they get rid of it, right? So there's a hygienic process going on all the time. It's a host parasite war going on all the time between, the bee and this very tiny fat sucking tick, right. Very destructive for the pupae and just wears and just tires out the adult bees. So you can imagine if, the balance tips, the infestation can be overwhelmingly bad. And it's an incredible article. It's such easy access. People just go and get the Weekend Australian from last weekend and read the article by Greg Bearup, because it describes the biology and the problem the industry faces in an extraordinary lucid detail. And the tragedy now that's unfolding, particularly for key beekeepers like David Vile and his wife, who spent their whole life developing beehives and a specialised process to look after the bees. They really look after the bees like their own children. All of the beekeepers do that. They have an amazing dedication to it. And the last thing in the world they would want to do would be to destroy their bees or have infected bees or sell infected product to all of their customers, because they have very big reputations and they're key parts of the industry. Well, he was part of this strike. This June strike, which they now think struck, and this is where I became interested. They now think struck in December 2021, not in June. And the big issue has been, where did it come from?
Right, yeah.
Because we have such strong border security, in Australia. Where did it come from? The current theories are that it could have come from a ship with bees in the Tasman Sea off the coast, north of Newcastle. It was anchored or was going past, and the swarm went out, infected, made strikes on the beehives and on the pollen, let's say. We're feeding on the pollen. But you see, as I said, mites get onto the pollen. So, and that's important to understand this life cycle. If, for example, an infected bee goes to a pollen source, a flower, and starts feeding on it, you know, with the nectar and picking up the pollen, the mites jump off that bee and get into the site. So the next bee that comes along who's not infected becomes infected with the mite. You see how it spreads?
Yep, so they pass it on.
Yeah, they pass it on. So it's not as if it's a just simple, you know, it's quite a complex host-parasite relationship. So the big issue is, where did it come from? Was it a passing ship? And now they know. Now that they know that it's in, that it started in December, that's deepened the whole problem, because all of their contact tracing has been excellent. The Department of Primary Industry in New South Wales has been incredibly good. Just reading the story, how efficient they've been in tracking everything down. Now, what they're waiting on are the genomic sequence, that is the genome. It's about 7 to 14 chromosomes of this little mite. Mm-hmm. They'll get the genomic sequence, and it will have distinguished. And I'm absolutely certain, from my knowledge of wider biology and particularly genome biology, absolutely certain that it will have a distinctive signature of the region of where the mite came from. Was it in Europe? Was it North America? Was it Hawaii? You know, was it South America? Or was it New Zealand? You see, New Zealand came on board with the infestation 22 years ago. Up until the year 2000, New Zealand was free of this thing.
Same as us.
Just like us.
Yeah.
They got it, and they can't get rid of it. It's all over the country. So New Zealand, the closest country apart from Indonesia, is New Zealand, which has these mites. So, that's what I want to talk about.
You mentioned the wind structure. Well, a lot of southeasterly winds would be blowing from New Zealand towards Australia, I would think.
Yes, they do. If you look at the wind maps, they go east-west from New Zealand. And you know where they primarily hit across the Tasman? The central coast of New South Wales.
Right. So that could be a source of the original infestation.
Yeah, I don't think it can be discounted.
Right.
And given what I've told you about my review of a broad review of the literature of wind pollination and wind transportation of plumes, and going over, and this has been well studied, it's a big scientific literature on this, over long distances, that's not implausible, is it?
Certainly not. And Ted, just on that very point, therefore, if they can do genomic sequencing on these mites, and they would, if they did a quick look through that and did a comparison with New Zealand, they might find a connection.
Well, that's right. So this hypothesis I'm offering, directly tested. Now, if it's not New Zealand, New Zealand's ruled out. So we get back to the ship or an illegal operator that's brought hives in from northern hemisphere.
Yeah,
you know, that's another problem, of course, that they're fighting all the time.
But I think, just as a little pointer on all of this, is, you know, I talk to people and knowing we were going to have a chat about it, and it's, most people don't know very much about how important the bee industry is to the horticultural industry of Australia.
Oh, yeah, they don't realize.
It's massive.
It's massive. It's key. Just the almond industry, right? Just the almond is $1 billion industry. I mean, they've got the other fruits and nuts.
Yeah.
And for example, the article Greg Bear up, you know, quite well, you know, reports that there's a requirement in the Riverina, the fruit growing regions of Victoria and southern New South Wales right now, they need 70,000 hives, and they don't know where they're going to get them from.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a tragedy all of a sudden, isn't it? So I think that probably leads on to how we manage the infestation now.
That's
that it's,
right.
It's here now. How do we manage it? Because we just can't go out and slaughter them all. We've got to say, obviously, other countries around the world are coping with it at all times.
They are. I think we've got to start. We've got to say, hey, just wait a minute. All these other countries are managing it. Even the United States, a major agribusiness, agriculture country, is managing it. So it really comes down to doing things sharper and smarter, it seems to me, understanding this behaviour, this incredibly healthy behaviour of bees, for example, and develop lines that, you know, are very efficient at weeding out. There's all sorts of – and another thing I noticed in my reading was that, for example, when they did a direct comparison between Italian hives and Slovenian hives, they found – Italian hives were much better at the health hygiene than the Central European hives. Now, the bees were just better now for whatever reason. Little bits of knowledge like that are important in bee improvement and bee hygiene behaviour with respect to these mites.
Now, if we've got different bees around the world being smarter, we need to be studying what they're doing versus what we might have to do with ours, I should suspect.
Yeah, I think we're going to be forced to. As I said, there's no place on earth that's got rid of an infestation once it's taken hold.
Now,
very depressing, isn't it?
Well, it's more than depressing, because if we've got a whole horticultural industry, dependent on the health of the beehive industry, and then we've got a concern developing, we need to be balanced in how we manage the infestation. That's certainly important. There's many that we were going to touch on foot and mouth disease with another gentleman, because we just can't go off slaughtering and destroying a component of an industry. You can't do it. You've got to have to be more sensible. And I think it's important that we make that notation, because without it, we can have a sort of a shoot from the hip and ask questions later approach by our political class. And we don't want that to be a situation. We need sensible, calm, thoughtful management of a critical situation, I would have said.
Yes. We've got to start.
We'll come back to it in a moment. Okay, we'll just pop off for a quick ad, and then we'll be back in a few minutes.
TNT Radio's Joseph Arthur.
Pelosi tiptoed around the issue of U.S.-China relations Friday as she wrapped up her swing through Asia, knocking Beijing's human rights record before insisting in the next breath that America had to work with its superpower rival. I have said it again and again, if we do not speak out for human rights in China because of commercial interest, we lose all moral authority to speak out about human rights any place in the world, she told reporters during a news conference. Well, statements like this certainly don't calm the situation between these big junkyard dog nations, and they're probably not meant to. Whatever righteous explanations she can make about her reasons for going to Taiwan, they cannot really justify the minefield we have now stepped in as a nation. It all just seems an unnecessary complication. You pick your battles, and we can hardly justify being world police with our country in the state that it's in. Claiming a moral high ground strikes me like a bit much. And the way that it's going, we don't have the resources on any level to really contend with this right now, spiritually, mentally, physically, financially. Chaos closing in on every angle and at every level.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
A lot of people may not agree with us right now, but there may come a time when they actually have an issue that affects them, that they don't have the freedom to choose. And if we don't preserve it, we won't have it.
You get to see this for yourself.
We begin this new week with an extraordinary moment in our history. 18 days into this truck convoy, and the federal government invoked a security measure that goes beyond anything seen in this country in the last 50 years.
Banks will be told to freeze the accounts of anyone helping finance the protests. And the owners of vehicles jamming streets will be directly targeted.
Trucking for Freedom, Chapter 1, How We Got Here. Visit truckingforfreedom.com.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
We're back again. Richard Carson here. Politically Incorrect is the hour, and I'm joined by Professor Ted Steele, and we've been making a small observation of a varroa destructor that is infecting our bee industry, but more importantly is how we now manage, and we don't go as we've done with the coronavirus and have lockdowns and destruction and complete slaughtering of the bees. We need to be very measured, calm and collected in how we manage it. Professor Steele, what do we do? Do we just go along with the quiet approach, or how do we go about it?
Well, it's certainly quite a bit since last weekend, hasn't it? There's no hysteria in the media, which is a good thing. Because that hysteria and the stampede that creates, the fear is what the worst thing in the world. That's what happened with COVID, and I'll get to that shortly. But we've got to be calm and methodical about it. We also got to be open-minded about where it came from, so that we're aware of what might happen again with something else that's similar. Okay.
Yep.
Now, the reason I've mentioned pollen plumes in the wind and coming across the Tasman from the, you know, the infestations in New Zealand is for what we know happened. That necessarily didn't happen on the pollen, what I'm going to tell you now, you know, that's a hypothesis. But with COVID, we know that something quite extraordinary happened in December globally. Now, without going into all, without going into all of the you know, the origin and global spread mechanisms that we've discussed repeatedly on TNT, what we observed in using you know, the COVID PCR test from the global epidemiology for the you know, the tail of the pandemic, which was the Omicron Delta end of the pandemic, something quite extraordinary happened in Australia, which was clear to me and all my co-authors. It was obvious what had happened. What happened through mid-December to late December, an amazing number of cases just rocketed through the roof. That is PCR detections. I'm not saying they're serious. It was not all a common cold, but nevertheless, the detections were telling us something. And it went from hardly anything, which we had in the previous 2 years, despite all the convulsions we went through over the previous 2 years, Australia had hardly had any serious size numbers. It was totally off the Richter scale, our response to the minuscule number. But from mid-December and into the first week of January, this is what happened in New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, South Australia, and Tasmania. But at the same time, I've got to stress this, at the same time as it happened here, that is the same time period, the same 24 to 48-hour time period, it happened in New York, New Jersey, Hawaii, the island of Aruba, many countries in Europe, Florida. What happened was a hockey stick curve of infections. Now, you know, a hockey stick has the base where you hit the ball.
Straight up.
Yep. Now, just imagine that plot. That's what I call a hockey stick plot or a J curve, but it goes straight up. And it's, you know, it's super exponential. It just doesn't go up, you know, leisurely, one, then five. It goes 1, 100, 10,000, 100,000. It goes up.
Economically.
Astronomically, yes. Yep. That's the key thing. But the point is that hockey stick, just imagine that, have that in your head now. That hockey stick occurred at the same time across Australia, except Western Australia and New Zealand. You've got to get that very clear from mid-December to the first week of January. And in all those other countries I mentioned, there are a large group, and there's many missed out, but on this, or we're not reporting data. When there's, you know, a negative result could mean two things: it's missed out or it's not reporting data. And many countries in Africa were probably not reporting. But anyway, getting back to the hockey stick graph, so we interpreted that at two levels. First level was it happened simultaneously all over the world, to exposing, and these cases occurring in millions and millions of people all over the world at the same time. So it couldn't be person-to-person spread, right, of the Omicron. That's impossible. Now, the nature of it, though, fits in with all the other prior work we'd done on the solar minimum and the role of this solar pulse of electromagnetic pulses and solar wind that bring charged particles to Earth during the solar minima. And we happen to be right in a big solar minima, or we're just coming out of it. And so we interpreted that, although we couldn't give all the physics of it, as a manifestation of charged particles, that is viral laden dust clouds coming to ground at the same time, that is Omicron Delta, all over the world at the same time. So it's a solar weather, solar pulse event. But we made a very important qualifying paragraph in our paper. This is all published, by the way. And that qualifying was this: we're only monitoring one entity, COVID-19. And we suspected at the time there would have to be many other pathogens, potential pathogens and other types of dust particle, and maybe even pollen particles brought to ground at the same time.
Right. So You're tying what we saw with Omicron back into a widespread activity here that's caught the bee.
There was a discrete plume coming across from there. This is one simple way of understanding. It may not be true. A plume came out of pollen, which was infected with the mites. Pollen aggregates came over, got transported rather crisply. Quickly across the ditch, was hovering as a cloud, and then this pulse came and brought it down into the central coast and hinterland of New South Wales. So that's one way. And then by chance, some of it got into either the fruits or pollens that the bees feed on, or actually hit a beehive, you know, actually hit it.
That's the problem, Ted. It can happen anywhere at any time.
That's the point.
Under the circumstances of the whole of our universe being affected by, the sun is a very big beast.
Yes, that's right.
And it moves things around. And we as people need to understand that and be prepared for things that come out from left field. It's been going
totally
on.
Totally left field. You see, it's totally left field, isn't it?
It is. But the point is, Ted, we can look back in time where, people observed a major explosion in the night sky and then they waited for pestilence. That's written in books.
That certainly happened throughout China.
It's happened forever. So any of these things, I think your point is, Australia is not immune from being caught by something via the atmosphere and the
Absolutely.
Winds and the sky. So
can't be discounted.
So then once we've got them, it's evident elsewhere around the world, they're coping and managing. We need to take succor from what they're doing and not go out with wholesale slaughter of an industry. And help the horticultural industry in a responsible and sensible fashion. Would that be about where we've got to be?
Yeah, that's where we've got to go. And the article by Greg Beerhub was written very responsibly like that. Quite correctly induced that response from everybody. Every intelligent person reading it would see that. The tragedy of these key beekeepers, though, these people have spent their lives. So they're gone.
Well, that's because we're not probably being a bit more rational in how we manage, and you bring up the coronavirus response or the COVID responses of the Australian government and state and federal politicians has been off the planet, negative, wrong.
Yeah, it was basically the same quarantine and slaughter strategy.
Just stupid. So we can't allow that to happen in this instance. It's a different problem, but it's a similar scenario, and we've got to be responsible. I think we can hopefully make that notation. I would just touch on something that we've had the last couple of weeks on Politically Incorrect with the Great Barrier Reef,
which
a couple of about 5 weeks ago was dying. We had the good luck to speak to Dr. Karen Benn and then Dr. Peter Ridd, and all of a sudden, within about 9 days, it was in rude good health, which both of those people knew was the case anyway. But poor Dr. Ridd was pilloried by standing up and making the observation that wasn't dying while people were scamming and scheming. So we've got to be careful all over the place, sensible, manageable, decent responses to issues. It hasn't been evident in the last 2.5 years with coronavirus or COVID, as they call it. We don't want them destroying a quality bee industry and hurting people here with irresponsible activity.
That'd
be my call.
I'm not sure, I'm sure the experts will know how to handle this well. But for example, one thing that could be done to stop the real pain is that these particular keepers who spent their entire life dedicated to the bees and helping so many people, there should be some sort of compensation scheme to help them through into their old age.
Well, let's hope there is. And I think others will take up the cudgel and take up the cause because we mention it, we're talking about it for the very simple reason that people are being damaged and we don't need to damage a wonderful industry with irresponsible action by short-term political gain keepers or whatever you want to call them, because they make a hash of everything. They prove their incompetence at every single moment.
Oh, absolutely.
Unfortunately,
COVID, it was all exposed with COVID, wasn't it? We were exposed to it.
Now, we'll close off on the bees, otherwise they'll come and sting me. I wanted to just touch on another issue that you were embroiled in, if I may, and it came about from an interview with a gentleman called Norman Swan and I think Chris Goodnow. You might want to talk me through what happened there, because quite a lot of brouhaha developed in the last few weeks with you and other immunologists and whatever else.
I think
it's important, because what we're seeing is a lack of fairness and objectivity, which we've known for over two years now in the mainstream media. And we'll tell you what you need to be told, and that's it. And if there's any decent, what would I call it, obvious opposite point of view, it's shouted down unnecessarily without open and qualitative debate. and there's only one answer, and that's theirs. So I'd like you to sort of run me through what happened with this particular, when you heard this Norman Swan, Chris Goodnow interview, and then what ensued from that point onwards. It was quite a lot, I think.
Yeah, it did. A lot happened, and it'll probably have to, we'll have a break, and then it'll have, we'll have to continue after the
break. Oh, no, we can carry. We'll go up to quarter two, we can break.
Well, it means I can adequately describe some of this then.
You've got about 15 minutes.
Yeah, right. Well, on July 18th, Dr. Norman Swan, the health journalist and the chief supremo for biomedical science, by the way, at the ABC, as I've discovered over the years, he at 5:30 on that afternoon, he interviewed Professor Christopher Goodnow, who's a molecular and cellular immunologist, much like me. He's about 15 years behind me in age, but his knowledge base should be similar to mine. It would be different. He was very specialised in certain areas that I'm not. His early career, and I met Chris in the late 80s when he was finishing his PhD, was extraordinary. He did some extraordinary experiments, genetic experiments, in the late 80s as a young scientist, and I was really impressed, and so were many other people. I've heard other stories since, and this tends to happen with all the jealousies and professional jealousy, but nevertheless, it was very important work. But then I noticed his evolution from, you know, bright young scientist to, well, what's happened to many of my colleagues? They became corrupted at some point. In their development through the institutions, rather than calling a spade and calling out the truth on important issues, they either remained silent or they just deliberately produced misinformation, or they actually tried to suppress people, you know, through the peer review system. So it's very disappointing that that was a trajectory that I think Professor Christopher Goodnow chose. Anyway, the reason he was on with Norman Swan is that he's a senior immunologist in Australia, okay? He wasn't necessarily all the time in the public arena advocating vaccines and masks and lockdowns, but he was there at the start. I remember he was there at the start in April 2020, and it would be how genomics would, you know, contribute to a massive solution to COVID. Well, I just said he would heave up. I said, how absurd is that suggested? Yeah, so please don't contribute to any more of the BS that's circulating out there in the public domain. It appeared in the Australian. Anyway, he never got back to me. I said, please, just stop doing that sort of nonsense. Anyway, he never got back to me. But the point was his latest foray into the public domain is incredibly revealing because he's been on the receiving end of all my astringent, if you like, email broadcasts of the knowledge about the origin, global spread and the vaccine efficacy of COVID for about 2 years now. And I suspect a lot of them are probably deleting or sending it to spam, but I know a lot of them are reading it, and I know that now by what's happened this past week, that they were all reading what I was sending them. And this is why I know that. Well, let's just get back to the Norman Swan interview. It was an extraordinary interview. In fact, Mike Ryan, who interviewed us on the August the 3rd, which is about 15 days later, he also heard the interview, and his description of it was like Monty Python's and 40 Towers meets the Marx Brothers on the ABC radio. It was an extraordinary spectacle of both ignorance and, if you knew many of the facts, you had to laugh, but it was tragic laughter. You were laughing in a tragic way because, you see, Chris was on the show because he was, you know, a senior immunologist at a major research institute in Australia, and he was four times boosted in May, caught COVID, then shortly afterwards had a heart attack. And the title of the show was Norman Swan Interviews Christopher Goodnow on His COVID-Associated Heart Attack. And, of course, the implication was it was COVID that caused the heart attack, when in actual fact all of the evidence globally now indicates that that's the classic adverse event sequence for the COVID-19 RNA, mRNA vaccines, right?
That's a very good point, because, unfortunately, I'm aware of three people who've had the same heart attack but didn't have the luxury of instant help, and they all succumbed to it. I think this gentleman was lucky enough to be taken to
in a hospital setting, so he attended to pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's great that he got that, but a lot of people don't.
He certainly described all his symptoms after the COVID was bad, and then he got the heart attack. So he had bad COVID, and then he got the heart attack as well.
Yeah.
But that's another thing that's going on now, this whole phenomenon of long COVID. It's everywhere in Australia now. For that reason, we hardly had it. And then that strike in December, now everyone's been vaccinated, and now we're getting the complications of the population-wide vaccination program in Australia. And long COVID is one of the longest symptoms of it. In other words, people who've got vaccinated don't handle COVID very well. People who refuse to get vaccinated may get a common cold or a bit of a sniffle, but they handle it. They don't suffer these incredible complications which allow them to end up in hospital.
So, Ted, is that because the RNA component's diminishing their own immune system?
Is that possible or not? I don't know what it is, but the vaccination process itself, that could be part of it, but the vaccination process itself in the blood, of course, see, this is what we've had to repeatedly say on TNT, can't protect you against respiratory tract infection like COVID or flu. For that, you need to activate the immunity of the mouth, the nose, and the respiratory tract, right? It's a different type of immunity.
I say it simply, there's a vaccine that might help via the blood, but the vaccine that's being stuck into your hair can't help your breathing.
No, that's right.
That's how I just think. It just can't, hasn't, never will and won't. It's pointless.
That's right. And from April last year, when I was starting to turn my attention to the vaccine and gather momentum, I could see that the vaccine, one, was useless, couldn't work in principle, on first immunological principles. Two, is likely to cause serious problems because there was building up, adverse events were building up even at that point.
Yeah,
and particularly Dolores Kale pointed out one of the major ones, which is this one I think that's going on now with the long COVID, and that is the antibody-dependent enhancement. You know, he's getting the blood antibodies, which incite inflammation, and then getting COVID, and then you're getting all sorts of things that shouldn't have happened. If you'd had the natural infection and got over it, you wouldn't have got COVID again, because that's the way the immunity works, right?
Right.
But it was the extraordinary ignorance of Dr. Norman Swan, a medical doctor, and Professor Goodenow, a professor of immunology, who simply didn't understand that the mucosal immune system is different from the blood immune system.
That's the worrying point. Now, I'll cut in only to say that you're pointing this out to a huge cohort of immunologists and epidemiologists.
Yes,
a massive group. Yeah. And then I think you were taken to task quite bitterly by different ones you might like to touch on. I think there was someone like a Catherine Bennett.
Yes.
Well, but because you're pointing out that the coronavirus or the vaccination, as they call it, I think we call it an injection, doesn't work, you are then seen as a pariah to the, what would you call them, the pharmaceutical lobby group.
That's water up a duck's back. Look, it doesn't worry me.
No, that's fine. You're not worrying about it. But the actual attack that then is leveled against you and your other contributors of information around the world is really it's communism in the extreme.
Oh, absolutely. The medical tyranny and communism.
Yeah, and that's where I think the point is. So you might want to just roll through a bit of what then ensued from your questioning of the interview of Swan and Goodenow.
Right. I've given you a description of the Swan Goodenow, and the major defect was the lack of mucosal, and then the extraordinary ignorance on Goodenow's part that couldn't see that it was the sequence. You know, four shots, get COVID, get heart attack. That was the problem. It was the vaccine that was causing the problem. Anyway, on August the 3rd, Mike Ryan interviewed me, Steve Crothers, and Elizabeth Hart, and Steve came first for about half an hour, and really, it was all to do with the Swan and Goodenow interview. But Steve Crothers was brilliant. He just went through it all and pointed out, you know, that every part of it was nonsense, and it was just so illuminating to listen to these so-called experts just sprout nonsense and then advocate. See, they kept advocating the vaccination program and the masks and the lockdowns, even while this was happening in the interview. They kept advocating it, which is just extraordinary that they would do that.
But that's the problem. These people are forcing incorrect information on the population at large via, and I'm going to call it the publicly funded ABC in this instance, and yet there is no right of redress to say to people, hang on, these turkeys are wrong and it's not good. So keep going. We've got to go for a break in a few minutes. But
just keep running. Nonsense. Everything that they said was pure nonsense. And I got this podcast from Steve first, then Elizabeth was unmerciful in ripping it apart, you know, from the lack of informed consent to the mass vaccination program and the adverse events. And we, you know, and we talked, and then later we talked about Judy Wilderman's work on how all vaccines are dangerous. All of this, of course, is stuff they don't want to hear. This is really deadly, deadly stuff for the whole cartel that's been involved in this, I would say, quarantine and slaughter. That is, the slaughter being the mass vaccination rollout of something that's really quite toxic and dangerous and is damaging the human population big, big time. Anyway, I released on August the 8th the podcast of that hour-long set of discussions between Steve Elizabeth Hart, myself, and Mike Ryan. And Mike Ryan, of course, kept bringing us back to Monty Python all the time. He couldn't get over how stupid they were in the interview. Anyway, I released all that, and I put a rider on my short email to all my immunological friends, epidemiologists, and writers at The Australian. I said, it's actually in your interest to listen to hear what we're actually saying about you. And I always put that in there, because, you know, a lot of them are saying they sent me through to spam or they delete me or whatever. That might be the case. But the reaction that then took place indicates they were reading it all right. And they went completely bananas, because there was a delay of about a few hours silence. Then Elizabeth Hart jumped in with a little chip of Nick Cater, one of the weasel writers for The Australian, who, you know, sells himself as a conservative, who's actually never does the really nitty-gritty on the fact that the vaccine doesn't work and it's dangerous, right?
Come back to it in half a minute after. All right,
let's come back to that in a minute.
Please do.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
We've made a very serious discovery. If you look at CFACT, I published an article on correlation there. I guess it's a blog nowadays. But the serious discovery is there is a direct correlation between the increase in the price of postage stamps and CO2. Obviously, the increase in postage stamps is causing increasing temperatures and increasing CO2. So the solution is get the price of postal stamps down. Here's another ditty. More people get sunburned and melanoma in the summer. More people also eat ice cream cones during the summer. What does this tell you? We've got to get rid of ice cream. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist and ice cream lover Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, reminding you to enjoy your ice cream cone and the weather before someone takes both of them away from you.
Eggs. You can fry them, scramble them, poach them, boil them, or race them on a spoon. But uncooked eggs can be a risk for food poisoning. To be safe, avoid buying dirty or cracked eggs. Always wash your hands after handling eggs. And if you're concerned, pregnant, elderly, or have a poor immune system, make sure you cook eggs until the yolk starts to firm. Or look for new pasteurized eggs. For excellent eggs, handle them safely.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else.
You guys are talking about everything that I just wanted to ask about.
This is Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And I'm back with you, Richard Carson, Politically Incorrect. We're having a bit of a wide-ranging query session on the reaction of certain individuals in the mainstream media to what was seen as being reasonable and rational observation of circumstances. So, Professor Steele, just before we went to the break, you were talking about a reaction from a gentleman by the name of Nick Cater, I think, and other journalists at the weekend, or no, the Australian newspaper, I think it was.
Yeah, it was during the week. If this was, yeah. It would have been late on Monday night, August the 7th, or August
8th. A bit over a week ago.
Yeah, just this past week, and probably the next morning. Anyway, Elizabeth Hart chipped Nick Cater on an earlier comment he made, and that ignited a storm of attacks. You know, take me off, stop offending me with this stuff. That's basically what they're saying. Stop hearing. That means they're all listening. They were actually listening to the broadcast I was sending out. I mean, no question about it. And then they have a go at me, and people like Paul Monk started to chip in and throw his 2 cents worth in. And I could spend a long time talking about Paul because in many ways I respect him, but a lot of what he's talking there with that was a nonsense. But Chris Mitchell was very revealing. He says, Nick, don't waste your time with them. You know, he's a former editor of The Australian.
Is he not still the editor?
No, he's not still here. He's an American editor that writes every Monday.
Right.
Well, he was when I was buying the hard copy of the paper. I assume he still does. He's an emeritus editor, and he was telling Nick to stop worrying. They don't understand. They don't understand how the national media works, because we were really taking the Murdoch Corporation, you know, to task about its influence, and you know that the media operates this way. Well, I just simply said I think the media's also got to tell the truth and not spread lies and misinformation the way the Australian has repeatedly over a 2-year period, beginning with Natasha Robinson, but Nick Cater not telling the truth properly, Adam Crichton holding back on the critical information that he was getting repeatedly provided with. There were so many of them that were updated all the time. Even good guys like Steve Watterson, he was either self-censoring himself or he was getting overridden by a copy editor on whether the vaccines can protect and whether they could help you. So he couldn't see. They're the two critical things: can they protect and can they help you? And the answer to both is no.
So, and that's the very valid point that there is a plethora of information out there now. We had a gentleman on last week, Rainer Fulmi, yes. And he's a senior lawyer and he's taking a lot of people to task. But he was talking in he said it's a well understated number, but he disclosed to myself and Mike Tennessee that over 1 million people have died from being injected with this stuff. Now, that's crazy, crazy, crazy numbers. And these numbers are being questioned by being so understated. And yet you're trying to bring information, or you are bringing information, and these journalists and others are ridiculing you because you're pointing out valid points that they choose not to bring to the knowledge of the whole Australian population, as far as we're concerned, and it's happening right around the world. So we're not immune to these negative commentaries. But the fact is, you were the very person that was assailed by them in a very, I'd almost call it a juvenile fashion. It's almost like calling names in the schoolyard.
Very similar to that, yes.
And the fellow Mike
Toole, the epidemiologist from the Burnett Institute, when he gets these subtitles, I suspect he's drinking late at night when he gets some of these guys, because his response is completely crazy. Anyway, Catherine Bennett, the epidemiologist from Deakin University, just her mind's blown by the fact that these, you know, explanation about COVID is it's coming in from the sky, and that's the primary ignition event. She just can't get her head around it. Of course she can't, because it destroys all her other arguments. Everything else she's published or said about COVID would be nonsense if she wouldn't say it if she knew what the truth was. But so you see, I just signed off. I tried to put a line under this whole crazy response, but for me, trying to be a bit measured, and I just said, look, just here are the points about all our papers. I gave the links to all our papers.
What would there be, 30, 40 papers?
There's 22 papers.
22 now. Papers. Yeah, so there's a lot of information available if someone's upset about something for them to have a look at.
Yeah, and we've just got it out in a book, as you know.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we've got all our papers are collected in a World Scientific Publishing book called Understanding the Origin and Global Spread of COVID-19. All our papers from that whole period now are available in a book, rather than having to go to individual journal sites.
Professor Steele, but all this information is there. Yeah. We're listening to what we're being told by the inverted comma experts. Why can't they be decent enough to take full note of what you and a lot of other senior people are saying, and then have a balanced and open discussion? They don't want to know about it, I think, because they're on very, very thin ice.
Well,
Catherine didn't force me. Yeah, that's the answer, right? She just forced me. I said, well, look, these are the 5 or 6 points you've got to refute. I sent that around as my final email broadcast. I didn't get a response from her back. She just went to water.
But that's a very dangerous thing, because we're injecting people, and I am absolutely mortified that they would want to inject five-month-old babies.
Oh, that's appalling.
It's criminal. And, you know, people are dying, full adults are dying from this stuff. And then they want to put the junk into children, you know, five months old.
I was listening to Charles Covess before we came on the air.
Right.
And, you know, that whole issue was covered again with children and vaccination. And all rational sense can see this is just a massive problem now, this attempt to vaccinate children.
But this lady, Catherine Bennett, is she an immunologist?
She's an epidemiologist.
Epidemiologist or whatever she is.
Yeah, but she was a prominent talking head on TV and in the newspapers explaining the epidemic. She's got no idea what she's talking about.
But that's very dangerous. That the person is given some sort of authority.
Yeah.
And is either being forced to say things that are wrong, or is ignorantly saying things that are wrong.
That's right. Is it willfully ignorant or is it deliberate? You know, I reckon it's probably a combination of both when you look at the corruption chains.
Mm.
It's probably a combination of both.
Well, so you've had a bit of a run-in with a whole pile of people in mainstream media in the last week and a bit, but I'm fascinated there's another bloke that suddenly the press or whatever you want to call them are busy trying to find something new to terrify and frighten the punters with.
Yes.
Now, we've had monkeypox. That appears to be not getting many legs at the moment. It's just not happening. So we've got and what did I hear the other day? Langyu or something or other in China. Now, this is Channel 9. What do I call them? 9 Media or 9 MSN?
Mm.
And this was a new dangerous thing. Now, I think you know this bloke, Professor Sanjay Sena.
Yeah, well,
help me here, because he was the one being interviewed for yet another scaremongering piece of rubbish. You might like to run through.
Yeah, that. Right. He was. That's
don't hold back. This is yet another disgrace. This is the barrier reef in reverse again.
Yeah,
you know, the barrier reef's bloody fit. But they were running a lie to pick up hundreds of millions of dollars for whatever they could go and drink bloody champagne or something. Now this turkey's come out of left field with some new piece of. But when you read into it, the headline says "Look out," and there's nothing to look out for.
Yes,
there you go.
Well, his name's Professor Sanjaya Sanana Yaki. He's an infectious diseases expert at the ANU in Canberra. He's been oiling over the TV screens from April 2020. Popping the mainstream mantra, vaccinate, wear masks, lockdowns, you know, whole thing, total nonsense. He's been getting away with it now for 2 years. The trouble is I know him. I haven't met him personally, but I know some of my co-authors have. But I've had a lot to do with him in the year before COVID, and particularly the 6 months before COVID struck. Because he got in touch with us, particularly he got in touch with Professor Wickramasinghe first, and then I became part of the loop, and there was very interesting discussions going on. He's an infectious disease expert, and he published with us in July a paper which was called...
July 2019, actually.
It was before COVID hit the TV screens in January 2020. So
right.
It was entitled Space Weather and Pandemic Warnings, and it was just a simple summary of everything I just told you about all those hockey stick graphs. That's what happened during the minima, and he brought to our attention an extraordinary phenomenon that happened in 2009, and that was at the dip of the last previous minima, right?
Right, right,
right. And he said Candida auris, a yeast fungal infection, appeared, and he presented all the papers, it's a well-known phenomenon, appeared suddenly in 4 different locations all over the world at the same time, and no one can explain it. There's a number of theories on fungicide resist variable fungicide resistance doesn't explain the emergence suddenly in 4 different parts of the globe, like Africa, South America, India, Southeast Asia, India. Anyway, it was an extraordinary story, and I don't want to go into details now. So we actually invited, Chandra and I knew that we had a book coming out called Cosmic Genetic Evolution, and we said, look, we're going to publish some peer-reviewed papers, invited papers in this Elsevier academic volume. And so we
we proposed towards the end of 2019 that he organise all the information on Candida auris for us. And he did. Yep. He basically wrote the first section of this paper I'm going to identify now. And it was all lucid and it was very, very good. Yet, and you know, but then COVID struck. And while I was exchanging manuscripts with him on what we were going to, you know, we were going to include COVID now in this as well, because they're both suddenly emergent diseases, he just jumped ship. He said, sorry, I can't be co-author. He just pulled out. And his reason at the time, it makes sense now, he says, because I'm going to be asked to make public commentary at Canberra Hospital on the pandemic. That was his reason. Well, certainly he did that, didn't he? Because for the next 2 years, he was on the TV screen, dominating it.
But
he knows where they come from. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, so he has deliberately obfuscated the potential arrival of the virus via the winds in the space.
Exactly.
And he knows all that, but he just ran for cover because he's got another agenda.
Yeah, and he was on the receiving end of all these.
Well, he's talking up this something or other out of China. We haven't got time to go through, but it just astounds me that this type of individual is out there.
Muddying
the waters of decency and honesty and choosing to take the king or the queen's shilling while not being honest or upfront about information that he has and knows.
It's finally got to be made public about Sanjaya's Sananayaki's history in relation to the diseases.
Right. Well, you've put him on notice. We've been put on notice by the producer.
Yes.
So we can head home for dinner or whatever you were going to go and do. So, Professor Steele, thank you for joining us for some interesting elucidation of what's going on out there.